First reading this morning is from Isaiah, the 59th chapter, verse 4 and verses 14 and 15. No one calls for justice, nor does any plead for the truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity. Justice is turned back, and righteousness stands afar off. For truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. So truth fails, and he who departs from evil makes himself a prey. Then the Lord saw it, and it displeased him that there was no justice. And then Proverbs chapter 2, verses 6 through 9. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth came knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice and preserves the ways of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity, and every good path.
Thank you, Jimmy. Good morning, everyone. Last Sunday morning, we began a new series dealing with the more common criticisms that people in our society raise against Christianity. Now, I recognize in embarking on this series that I am largely speaking, I'm speaking to the choir here. I doubt seriously that there are very many people in this audience who really struggle with some of the issues that we're going to be talking about. So why spend all of this time with this? Why not give you what you feel in your place at this point in your life? There are two reasons why it's important that we address subjects such as we're talking about in this series. Number one, maybe you don't need this instruction. Maybe you don't need convincing of the truths that we're talking about in this series. But your children are right now immersed in a culture that is very hostile to your faith. They are being exposed to influences and philosophies that you probably were not exposed to and did not grow up with in your younger days. Think of the children sitting right next to you in the pew with you and recognize they need to hear this because they're certainly hearing these criticisms and the influences that they're exposed to out in the world. And the second reason why it's important that we address this for our own benefit is because if, in fact, we are to be a light to the community and the world around us, if the light of the gospel of the Lord is going to be made known, made clear, made manifest to the population outside the walls of this building, you and I have to be prepared to explain why we believe what we believe. Just simply falling back on the old standard answer, well, because the Bible said so. I'm sorry, that just doesn't cut it anymore in our society. Now, when I grew up in my age, yes, everybody believed the Bible. Everybody believed in God. Everybody believed in Jesus. It was just a matter of straightening some folks out and some details about what the Bible taught. But everybody could go back and look at the Bible and recognize it as the standard of authority. Those days are gone. We don't live in that kind of world anymore. And consequently, just simply quoting Bible to people isn't going to convince them of anything. We have to be able to meet people where they are at, as Paul did in Acts chapter 17, speaking to the philosophers in Athens. He was dealing with people there who knew nothing about the true God. They knew nothing about his scriptures. And so Paul, it was pointless for him to start quoting Old Testament scripture to them. It meant nothing to them. He took a completely different approach. And that's really what we're trying to do in this series, is to help all of us have a better appreciation for why people, the intellectual reasons, why people reject the faith, why they reject truth, why they reject God. And to be able to, on their own terms, deal with their criticisms, deal with their problems with the faith that we profess. Last week, we were looking at the subject of truth. We talked about the fact that everybody believes in truth. They may not recognize it, but everybody believes it. In fact, it is impossible for us to live our lives without the truth. Everybody at some point, by some definition, has to recognize, yes, truth exists. It is something that is outside of ourselves. It is external. It is objective. We don't make it up to suit ourselves. And we started with that topic because it's so extremely important before we can discuss anything else in this series to recognize that, yeah, there's some truth out there that I need to recognize and appreciate and conform my life to. Now, the question is, what is that truth? And that's what the remainder of this series is all about. And that's why today, then, we're going to deal with the biggest question that people have today, and that is the question of God. Is there a God? If so, who is He? And what role does He play in my life? What do I owe Him? Now, there's so many different arguments that we could make for the existence of God. And if you want to get involved in the whole realm of apologetics, there's an enormous amount of material that's available out there approaching the question of God from a variety of different angles. One of the big ones is, why does anything exist at all? Where did everything come from? We're not going to pursue that in this lesson this morning. There is, however, one other approach that I think does deserve our attention. And the more time I spend in this particular area of apologetics, the more I appreciate the fact there's power in this approach. It is something that everybody, even the most ardent atheist, has to struggle with, because it deals with something that we all know and appreciate. And that is the idea of justice, or to use another term that's very popular today, human rights. And what we're going to talk about today is justice or human rights. What is it? Where does it come from? Why is it important? And all of this ties into the connection with God. Look again at the passage that we used as a foundation for last week's lesson in Isaiah 59, that Jimmy read just a moment ago. Last week we were emphasizing what this chapter says about truth. But I want you to notice as we skim through these verses again this morning that alongside truth is the idea of justice. Truth and justice stand or fall together. In verse 4, no one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. In verse 14, justice is turned back. Third line, for truth is fallen in the street. And then in verse 15, so truth fails. And then the last line, there is no justice. Truth and justice are going to be found together. So if, as we saw in last week's lesson, truth is real, truth is objective, truth is something out there that we need to conform our lives to, then justice is going to be trotting right alongside of that truth. You cannot talk about truth and acknowledge the reality of truth without at the same time acknowledging the importance and the reality of justice or human rights. So what we're going to do is look at these three questions. What is justice? Why is it important? And where does it come from? Well, what does all that have to do with God? You may wonder, as we walk through this lesson this morning, he's not saying a thing about God. We'll get there. Just bear with me. Now let's start out talking about the initial question, what is justice? Now you can go to a variety of dictionaries and come up with a number of different definitions. One dictionary defines justice as the establishment or determination of rights according to the rules of law or equity. Another defines it as the attainment of what is just, especially that which is fair, moral, right, merited, or in accordance with law. A third source defines justice as the quality of being fair and reasonable. And yet another definition, fairness in the way that people are treated. And we could multiply definitions, but you're beginning to see a pattern here in all these efforts to define what justice means. But I want you to notice these definitions. There are two words that keep floating to the top. And the two words are fair and law. That which is fair is referring to that which is equitable or honest or respectful. We all know that we want to be treated fairly, whether we believe in God or not. At this point, we can say the God question really doesn't matter. I know when I'm being treated unfairly. Right? We all do. We want justice in our lives, justice in the way that other people deal with us. And of course, we would expect they would want justice coming from us. But notice the second word that is often used in these definitions is the idea of law. That there is, in fact, some kind of code, some kind of system of rules. There's a boundary that defines what justice is. And again, that justice is based on an external truth. It is something outside of ourselves. We do not make it up for ourselves. The concept of justice, or human rights, in other words, is something that is universally recognized. We all recognize the need for justice, the importance of justice, and especially as it relates to ourselves. Young people, if somebody steals your lunch from your locker at school, is that just? Is that fair? Is there a law against that? School law, anyway. Well, of course. You don't appreciate it when somebody steals from you. If older people, somebody steals your identity, takes out a few credit cards in your name, racks up thousands of dollars in debt in your name that you're accountable for, you just shrug it off and say, oh, well, that's life. No, that's not just. That's not right. My rights have been violated. And I expect something to be done about that. And we could multiply examples of this. We all know instinctively, living in this world and rubbing elbows with people all around us, there are just certain rules, certain laws, if you will, that we expect everybody to follow. There are rights that accrue to me and to you as human beings, members of a common race, that we just instinctively understand they have to be there. Or bad things are going to happen, both to us individually and as a society. And that, of course, brings up the next question that we want to consider, and that is, why is justice important? Now, before we answer this question, let's start out by taking the assumption that really dominates our society today, and that is that all of us are here through a process of random evolutionary development. There is no God. However, the whole process got started way back in the beginning. We are just the random outcome of these processes that had no intellect, no mind, no design behind it. And so here we are today. And we're just going to say that human rights are important because, in this environment, because of evolutionary theory, this is why we still believe that human rights are important. Some say, well, it's because human beings ought to be free from coercion. It's the whole idea of freedom here, is that we really don't want other people telling us how to live our lives. That's not right. That's not fair. We don't like it when it happens to us, so we shouldn't do it to other people. It all comes down to the matter of freedom. Now, stop and think about that for just a moment. Do you really want to live in a world where everybody has absolute freedom to do whatever they want. If you run a business and you hire somebody, I'm going to pay you so much money, and this is the work I expect you to do, and the first day they don't show up to work. And you call them up and say, well, why aren't you here? Why didn't you show up for your job? Well, I'm free. I just don't want people telling me what to do, so I decided I'm just not going to come in today. Now, how long are you going to put up with that? When that person signs on to work for you, they have surrendered some of their freedom, have they not, in order to accrue some benefit to themselves, the paycheck that you give them. And you can multiply examples like this. When you decide to get married to someone, you fall in love with someone, you get married with them, I'm going to spend the rest of my life to you, what have you just done by coupling your life with theirs? You've surrendered some of your freedom. If you haven't figured that out yet, your marriage is probably in trouble. The idea of just absolute freedom to do whatever I want, it's a fantasy. Nobody really believes that. So just from the outset, that statement by itself doesn't really mean much, does it? Why should freedom be an ultimate value? Anytime it becomes an ultimate value, anytime freedom becomes the absolute standard by which we measure every moral or ethical decision that we make, chaos follows. We cannot set this up as the defining explanation for why human rights are important. Some would suggest, well, human rights, justice, is important in order to ensure the survival of the human race. Now let's get back to our starting point here. We're approaching this question from the standpoint, God does not exist. And all of us are here as a result of this random process of evolutionary development. But what's the basic law of evolution? Survival of the fittest. The strong eat the weak. Where does survival fit in there? Well, it's whoever comes out on top. Have you known anybody, either in your personal life or throughout history, who operated on the basis that the strong eat the weak? And the human race is governed by the principle of the survival of the fittest. It's not a very pleasant picture, is it? Now, you watch a nature documentary on PBS of the lion chasing the antelope and then devouring the antelope. Were the rights of that antelope violated? Was there justice done there? Well, we watched that and it's kind of gruesome. We shrug our shoulders and say, oh, well, that's nature. Just doing its thing. Survival of the fittest. Antelope wasn't fast enough. And nobody, well, very few people, want to apply that same principle to the human race. Well, it applies in the other species, but not to us. I ask, why not? Why not? If we are products of random blind evolution, what Richard Dawkins called blind, pitiless indifference, that's material naturalism. That's evolution. If that is in fact what governs every living thing on the face of this planet, what makes us so special? Why do we set ourselves apart and say, well, we ought to have the right to survive as a species, as a race? The very starting point itself argues that we came from nothing, and where will we all end up as a race? Nothing. In a few billion years, Earth is going to expand and burn up this planet and everything on it, and it will be as though none of us ever existed. So why is the survival of the human race such a big deal? You cannot make a rational argument that enshrines this concept of human rights on the basis that, well, we all need to survive, because there's nothing in the evolutionary mindset and the naturalist approach to reality that argues that that is an important value. Some will say, and related to this, that, well, justice is important in order to promote human flourishing. That's a common phrase that you'll hear often, that in order for us as human beings, both individually and as a collective, in order for us to really flourish and to develop our capabilities and our potential as human beings and as a race, that there are just certain rules that have to be in place for us to cooperate with one another. And it all sounds fine and good until you pose the next logical question, and that is, okay, who gets to define human flourishing? What if your definition of human flourishing does not line up with mine? Whose gets to apply? Which rule or which definition do we go with? Hitler thought he was doing the human race a favor by exterminating Jews and gypsies and gays. And he did it by the millions. In his mind, in the mind of the society that he ruled over, this was the correct thing. The human race needs to be purged of these undesirable elements. Now, we look upon that with horror and say, that's outrageous. He shouldn't have done that. They thought it was the right thing to do. They thought this is what the human race needs in order to really elevate itself to a higher level, a higher plane. Who's to say they were wrong and we are right? Who's going to define what we mean by human flourishing? Yes, you can talk in broad generalities like this, and everybody will agree with it until you get down to the nuts and bolts of what that means. What is human flourishing? Our society today is being torn to shreds by competing visions of what it means for human beings to flourish, because different people have different definitions of that. We can't agree among ourselves as to what human flourishing is all about. So you see, from an atheistic perspective, this whole idea of justice or human rights is simply a mirage. It's an opinion, is what it comes down to. I prefer this, you prefer that. So we're stuck with the question, okay, whose definition comes out on top? Who's going to get to define human rights? And that brings us then to the final question that we want to consider. Where does justice originate? How can we find an ultimate source of the definition of human rights? But again, let's start with the premise that there is no God, that we are all here living together as a result of this blind, pitiless indifference, evolution just doing its thing, survival of the fittest, natural selection. Then what are the answers that we can provide for this question? Where does justice originate? Some will argue that, well, each individual just has to create his own version. And that is why we have so many people today who are saying, I have my morality, you have your morality, and you don't force your morality on me. Gets back to the freedom idea again, right? And I would ask, in the light of the evolutionary mindset that dominates our society, what's wrong with that? The lion enforces his morality on the antelope, and well, too bad to be the antelope. Isn't that really the direction that we're going when we say that each one of us is free to create his own version of morality? The net result of that approach, when you've got millions of people in society who decide that each of them can define morality or justice or human rights according to their own desires and opinions, is anarchy. Read the book of Judges. Several times in that book, we're told that the philosophy that prevailed among God's people in that period of time was that every man did what was right in his own eyes. And it's one of the most depressing books you'll ever read because of all the crime and the violence and the selfishness that pervaded this society. These people were tearing themselves apart because everyone was defining their own morality. That can't be the source from which human rights are going to come. There's an interesting statement found in the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 15. It's a story of Absalom. Remember, Absalom was a son of David. In David's later years, Absalom had designs for the throne of Israel. And so he stationed himself at a prominent point in the city of Jerusalem, and his people passed by. Absalom would say this to the people. This is 2 Samuel 15, verse 4. Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice. Now, what is Absalom appealing to there? I'll give you justice. I'll give you human rights. I'll make sure that whatever case or concern or complaint that you have, I'll take care of it and everything will be fine. I'll fix it for you. Now, of course, if you're familiar with Old Testament history, you know that Absalom was a scoundrel. The only human rights this man was interested in was his own. What benefited him? What made him more powerful and more rich? And that was the principle that he lived on. He very, very nearly wrecked the kingdom of David. All in the name of justice, as he defined it. I will give you justice. And we have too many politicians today who are saying the same thing. Vote for me and I will give you justice. Based on what? You see, when we appeal to everybody making his own rules, defining justice and rights the way that it benefits them, everybody suffers in the long run. So the idea that each individual creates his own version has to be jettisoned. This is not going to work. And we have too many examples through history to prove that. Well, society has to define it. Obviously, we can't depend on each person to define justice themselves. So we have to define a larger body of individuals, society itself, to define justice, which again poses the question, okay, which society? Let's do a little what if here. We talked about Hitler and the Nazis and their approach to human rights earlier. What if the Axis powers had won World War II? And aside from the fact that we'd all be speaking German right now, what impact would that have on our society? What if Hitler and the Nazis had positioned themselves by winning World War II that they could implement their plans for their idea of human flourishing on the entire planet? What kind of world would we be living in today? Now, most of us would recoil from that thought and say that would be horrible. That would just be awful. And I would say, what's so bad about it? They won. We didn't. His society comes out on top. He gets to impose his idea of human rights and justice on everybody else. We're the antelope. He's the lion. Whose society gets to decide what is right or wrong? What is just and what is unjust? There are billions of people today who live in Islamic societies, societies in which women have zero rights, none, and are treated abominably. What if they reach the point that they control the world? Ladies, I'll let you answer that question. Do you just shrug your shoulders and say, oh, well, tough to be me? No, you say, that's not right. This is a violation of human rights. But again, assuming evolutionary theory to be the guiding principle by which we live, what makes your opinion worth anything? Anytime we say that society defines human rights or justice, we set ourselves up for these kind of contradictions that cannot really be resolved. Now, some atheists will go so far as to admit, okay, there is no such thing as justice, and human rights is merely an illusion. There's a book that recently came out by Yuval Noah Harari called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And here's a quote that comes out of this book. And I want you to think about this. Is this the kind of world that you really want to live in, where all the people in positions of power think this way. Here's what he says, quote, "There are no gods in the universe, no nations, no money, no human rights, no laws, and no justice outside the common imagination of human beings. According to the science of biology," that's evolution, "people were not created, they have evolved. And they certainly did not evolve to be equal. The idea of equality is inextricably intertwined with the idea of creation. The Americans got the idea of equality from Christianity, which argues that every person has a divinely created soul and that all souls are equal before God. However, if we do not believe in the Christian myths about God, creation, and souls, what does it mean that all people are equal?" Now let that soak in. This is what your children are being exposed to. This is the kind of thinking that permeates the society in which we live. People more and more are coming to the conclusion, you know, really human rights is just an illusion. It's just a fabrication. It's just kind of a common game we play among ourselves. We'll pretend that we all have human rights and that justice is a deal. But come on. Really, we know that's not the way it is. Do you think this might explain some of the fracturing of our society that we're witnessing today? The increase in violence and radicalism? Because after all, we're just very clever monkeys doing our thing, doing what evolution says we ought to do. And then that brings us to a fourth explanation that some atheists have started to acknowledge, and that is that we get the idea of justice by borrowing from Judeo-Christian religion. These are the honest atheists. They recognize in their more sane moments that there's no rational way to explain the existence of human rights other than we got it from the Judeo-Christian religion. For example, Friedrich Nietzsche, the famous German philosopher of the 19th century, who coined the phrase, well-known phrase, "God is dead," made this statement, "Another Christian concept has passed even more deeply into the tissue of modernity, the concept of the equality of all souls before God. This concept furnishes the prototype of all theories of equal rights." He's an atheist. He doesn't believe in God, but he recognizes in order to have equal rights or justice and human rights, you have to have something there. And the Jews and the Christians at least have that. And he acknowledges that modern Western civilization is based on this Judeo-Christian idea of God and equal rights. John Gray is another modern atheist still living who actually has done a very good job of taking his fellow atheists to task. He has jumped all over Richard Dawkins and some of the other new atheists in excoriating them for claiming that there can be human rights in the absence of God. Now, Gray himself is an atheist. He doesn't believe in God, but he recognizes that as an atheist, he has a problem here that is not really resolved. He makes this statement, "The secular worldview is simply the Christian take on the world with God left out. Humanism is not an alternative to religious belief, but rather a degenerate and unwitting version of it." In other words, you can live like a Christian, but you can't do that without Christianity. There has to be a Christian religion, a Christian faith, a belief in God and some kind of overarching system of laws regulating our conduct if we're going to live that way. And then finally, Richard Rorty, an American philosopher, was at Princeton and Stanford for a number of years, passed away about 10 years ago. He just admits, this Jewish and Christian element in our tradition is gratefully invoked by freeloading atheists like myself. Yes, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. I don't want there to be a God in my life. But I recognize I really need his religion in order to live in a stable, prosperous, free society. You cannot have human rights, a concept of justice, without some kind of acknowledgement of a higher power, a higher law superseding human desires and laws. As a result of this, there is currently a crisis in the field of human rights. Arthur Allen Leff was a young law professor at Yale Law School. He passed away, tragically, in the early 1970s, much too young. He was in his 40s. But he wrote a series of essays addressing the subject of the origin of human rights. Where do we get the idea that certain things, from a humanitarian standpoint, are just simply wrong, and other things are absolutely essential? Where do we come up with that if we leave God out of the equation? Now, Leff himself was an agnostic at best. He preferred to keep God out of the picture. But he, in this series of essays, did a powerful job of exposing the irrational approach of his fellow atheists in trying to explain the presence of human rights in the absence of God. And here's how he summarized it. This is a great article, Unspeakable Ethics, Unnatural Law. It's available on the internet, free, in PDF form. So if you're into that sort of thing, I would encourage you to download this and read it. It's an excellent article. But here's what he says. In the absence of God, each ethical and legal system will be differentiated by the answer it chooses to give to one key question. Who among us ought to be able to declare law that ought to be obeyed? Stated that baldly, the question is so intellectually unsettling that one would expect to find a noticeable number of legal and ethical thinkers trying not to come to grips with it. Either God exists or he does not. But if he does not, nothing and no one else can take his place. This is an atheist admitting this. If there is no God, we have no rational grounds for saying that there is such a concept as justice. It's the strong eating the weak, survival of the fittest. If you can make it, good for you. If you can't, too bad. It's every person for his or herself. And isn't this embedded in one of the foundation documents in our nation's history? The Declaration of Independence. In the preamble, we read these words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, people like to focus on those last few words. Certain unalienable rights. I have rights. There is justice. In this society, we demand justice, we demand rights, and they're unalienable. Nobody can take those rights away from me. We want that. But we want to ditch what was there just a few words before that. Where did those unalienable rights come from? They are endowed by our Creator. So many people in positions of power in our nation today no longer believe that. Now, they're playing the game. They want to hold on to the unalienable rights, but let's ditch God. Let's throw him overboard. We don't need the Creator anymore. We'll just hold on to the rights for ourselves. It doesn't work. You cannot have human rights. You cannot have justice without a Creator to make them, to enforce them. So we're stuck on the horns of a dilemma. We all agree that human rights exist because the alternative is just unthinkable. But we have no materialistic, no naturalistic explanation for those human rights. So if we're stuck on this dilemma, why don't we go back and reevaluate our initial starting premises, and that is evolution? Why not challenge that? Why not acknowledge the fact that there is a God? If there is a law, there must be a lawgiver. If there is an evaluation, if there is some kind of a judgment that some things are right and some things are wrong, then does that not imply there is an evaluator, a judge? Someone who has made the law and someone who will judge us on the basis of that law. I'm a preacher. I get paid for preaching the Bible. I've said very little about the Bible to this point in this lesson. I need to justify my paycheck. So let's go to the Bible, okay? Go back to this passage. In fact, if you have your bulletin, open that up and look at it. And here's the scripture that we read from Proverbs chapter 2. Verses 8 and 9 are the two statements that we want to look at. Verse 8, the writer says, concerning God, He guards the paths of justice, which is to say, God is the one who defines justice. He sets the boundaries around justice. He's the one who determines what justice is. And other passages in the Bible reinforce that thought. Psalm 89:14, righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Deuteronomy 32, all His ways are justice, a God of truth and without injustice. So it's God who guards the paths of justice. But look at the next verse, Proverbs 2, verse 9. Then you, speaking of us, you will understand righteousness and justice, equity, and every good path. How do you and I know justice? How do we have a sense of human rights? Some things being wrong, some things being right. The author says, you got it from God. He's the one that sets the terms. He's the one that defines what human rights is all about. It's up to us to simply understand and to recognize and appreciate what God has said about righteousness and justice. And how many times does this thought come before us in the Scriptures? Isaiah 1, verse 17, learn to do good, seek justice, rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow, stand up for human rights. Why? Because God wants that. God is the one who defined it. Zechariah 7, verse 9, execute true justice, show mercy and compassion, everyone to his brother. Amos 5, hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. Let justice run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. That last line should sound familiar. It was a verse that was used often in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. The rights of a certain segment of our population were being trampled. And to what source did the leaders of the civil rights movement appeal to have those rights fixed, made right? The Bible. Let justice run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. God is the one who defines justice. And if we're not practicing justice, if we're not respecting the rights of one another, that's on us. And we will be held accountable for it by the one who made those laws, God. Now, this whole lesson is designed to help us understand that there is a God. And I've taken a rather circuitous route to get to that point, but I hope now at the end you can recognize why this is so crucial to the question of the existence of God. If you believe in human rights, and more in our society, people are screaming about the rights of one another and themselves, fine and good, but you need to ask yourself the question, where does that come from? And the only rational answer that we can give to that is that it comes from God. When Jesus walked upon this earth, what did He teach? You take all the teachings of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount and everything else, his parables, and boil it all down. What was the message that He was trying to get across to the people that He was talking to? does it not boil down to justice? Respect the rights of one another. He taught the loftiest standard of human rights that has ever been taught by a wise person. But what happened to him? What became of this teacher of human rights? His enemies spread lies about him. He was betrayed by one of his own disciples. His friends abandoned him. He was convicted in a kangaroo court. He was unjustly condemned to death by a corrupt politician, and he was lynched by a mob driven by envy and hate. Every standard of human rights was violated. His rights were trampled. It was a terrible miscarriage of justice, and he was nailed to that cross. And there on the cross, what did he say to God? My God, why have you forsaken me? You are the God who guards the paths of justice. And why are you letting this happen to me? God, this is not right. This is not fair. You are not following through on your promise to your people. We recognize, of course, that the injustice that Jesus went through served a higher purpose. In a thousand ways, both great and small, you and I violate human rights in our lives, do we not? We do things that hurt others, and God's justice demands that every one of those violations be punished, be paid for in some way. So what happened to Jesus on the cross was, here's an innocent man who is volunteering to stand in for the guilty. Paul put it in these words in Romans chapter 3, that God demonstrated his righteousness that he might be just and the justifier, the one who has faith in Jesus. God is just. He's the author of justice. And he will do what is right. But in order to get you and I off the hook, to avoid being judged for the sins that we have committed, Jesus suffered the ultimate travesty of justice. He died for you and me. Does that mean anything to you? Does that change in any sense your understanding of what it means to be just and fair and equitable in your dealings with other people? Someday there will be a judgment when it's all the human race will stand before God to give an account for the things that they have done in the flesh. That's you and me. Every unjust act is going to be answered for. It's going to be paid for on that occasion. But there's one group who will not answer for their sins. Those who put their trust and faith in Jesus Christ. And to those people standing before God on that judgment day, Jesus is going to say, "Don't worry, Father, I paid for these. I paid the price for the sins that they committed." Do you want that in your life, in your future? If so, won't you come now and express your need as we stand and sing the invitation song?